Hello, I'm Steve Hallfish. Welcome to a special Voices from Sundance episode of the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. Sundance just wrapped up another exciting festival, virtually, from Park City, Utah, with indie filmmakers participating from around the world. These films usually come from interesting new voices, and we're happy to talk to one of them today. We're speaking with editor Nels Bangarter about the revealing archival documentary, Riotsville, USA. I last spoke to Nels on Art of the Cut on the release of another documentary, Dick Johnson is Dead. He's also edited documentaries including Camera Person, Let the Fire Burn, You See Me, and 32 Sounds. His work has been included on the PBS shows POV and Independent Lens, and on Dan Rather Reports. One of the things I think about documentaries is how they start is so important. Can you talk to me a little bit about the decisions that you and the director made on how this film was going to start?
Yeah, there are a lot of kind of rules of thumb among editors and filmmakers on how to do it. A lot of the thinking is around hooking the audience and putting a big idea out there in the beginning and kind of defining the terms and defining the tone of the film. And all these things are going on. But I do really love that the opening moments of a documentary, because you actually have really free rein, I feel like. In a way, I like to do a little bit of what I call kind of sticking the film's elbows out and doing something to sort of throw the audience off just a tiny bit. I always tell the directors, nobody's going to leave in the first 45 seconds. You might want to hook somebody within the first 10 minutes or the first 15 minutes. That's important. But for a little bit, you can kind of mess with people. You can kind of blow things up in an interesting way. And I mean, Riotsville, USA doesn't go too far in terms of that, but it does begin with this very strange footage that was really the central discovery of the director in terms of the archival research for this film, which was footage that exists of this military compound sort of Potemkin village called Riotsville, USA, or Riotsville, that was built for the military and police to do training to teach themselves, you know, how to try to stop the civil unrest that was going on in the mid-60s. So we begin the film with military footage of that village, but it's very strange footage. It's shot by soldiers and it's shot on 35, very weird camera moves and a guy riding around on a motorcycle, some soldiers kind of peeking out over rooftops. And it's meant to sort of develop a ominous but intriguing tone. And that's kind of what's coming for the rest of the film. It also gave us ample room for this beautiful voiceover that was written by Toby Haslett, which goes throughout the film. And it's kind of the most subjective part of the film. And the first segment of voiceover comes in that first couple minutes of the film. So it's doing a lot, but I love beginnings. I think they're just the spot where you can do anything you want, because the later you get in the film, the more hemmed in you are in some ways in terms of what the story is demanding, what the audience's attention is demanding, what exposition is demanding. And the beginnings, the sky is wide open for a moment.
Absolutely. And it also gives you a chance to like set the expectations of the style for the audience. Like, oh, it's going to be jump cutty. Okay, I got it. Oh, it's going to have voiceover. Okay, got it.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about documentaries is the openness of the form. And I think if you can develop that in the first, you know, somewhere in the opening of the film, it helps to announce the audience that this is going to be maybe a more unusual film than you might be used to.
Speaking about kind of style, one of the things that I liked, I wasn't sure whether I was assuming it was something that you did, but it could have been the way it was shot, was there's an opening march sequence where they're marching along and there's a series of jump cuts in there. Can you talk to me about deciding to do those fairly early so the audience is used to that style, or what the purpose of those jump cuts was?
This is in the village footage in the opening. There are legions of soldiers are marching by kind of in the middle distance of the camera. It's a pretty wide shot. And then they're followed by another legion of the people who are playing the rioters in the village. So they're dressed in street clothes. And the jump cutting in that sequence, in real life, it ran for a couple minutes and we only needed some subset of that. So I introduced the jump cuts there to kind of give the sense of the length of what was going on, but then also, you know, retain some energy. And then there's one, I think you may have noticed it, where it cuts back and forth sort of match cutting the civilians with the soldiers just for kind of a fraction of the second to, just a little touch in there in terms of the thesis of the film, essentially. The people who were the civilians in these recreations
were also soldiers.
They were also soldiers. So yeah, we're sort of making that point.
I head down as one of my notes, choice of music. Talk to me about temping and determining the tone of the film by the tone of the music.
C.R. Pettengill, the director, was in touch pretty early in the process with a composer named Jace Clayton, who works with analog synthesizers. And so he's there in his studio plugging chords into pedals and reverb things. I don't even know how it works. I've seen some video of it. It's a synth sound, but it's very rich and warm with analog circuits of all sorts. She wanted to use him for the composer, and it seemed right because it does sort of bridge this now then thing that's going on in Wrightsville, USA. I mean, it's composed of footage from the late 1960s, but it's a movie that was created now, and we're really conscious of that. And so Jace's music bridged that gap in a really compelling way. And the way he records it, he can't repeat anything that he's done. You know, he can't repeat it exactly.
Because this isn't like a synthesizer now that people think about where it's MIDI, and it's not totally what this is.
No, his is a wall. It's a wall of wires and cords.
Like an old Moog synthesizer, like a phone patch thing.
Exactly. Yeah, like phone patching. And so if he would have, maybe there's a way he could have recorded exactly the patching situations that he had. But even then, I think it's time dependent. So what he was sending us were sort of excerpts of half hour sessions or hour long sessions when the music that he was creating would go through a series of moods and moments. And then we'd sort of select those out and we could re-edit them a little bit. There was some sense of stems within that.
That's very interesting. So you were actually not using temp music.
Well, that oversimplifies a little bit. We did that with a lot of music that Jace had given us and use that in a sense as in a temp way. And then he went back and redid some more music for some of those sections. So some of the final music is what he gave us in the first few passes, and some is music that we replaced of his later in the process after Picture Lock.
So there's a narrator at the beginning, as you said, it's a lovely, beautifully written narration, but there's also the use of text on screen, and normally I see one or the other. Why do both?
So the voiceover was read by an actor named Charlene Modeste, who was amazing, and it was written by Toby Hazlett, the credited writer on the documentary, who's a great essayist, super smart. The way that works is, it's another element, I guess, in addition to the music, that bridges the now and the past of the footage. So it's written about what you're seeing in the film, but from a kind of modern point of view. It provides some sort of analysis, in a way, a political angle on what we're seeing. Whereas the text on screen is pretty precisely contained to exposition and facts. We divided the ways that they were being used in terms of, you know, this is presented as a pretty straightforward, verifiable, super closely vetted text in terms of the title cards, and then a kind of interpretation that comes through Toby and Charlene's work.
Yeah, more like an essay or a thesis.
Yeah, it's very essayistic.
You pointed out that the film starts out with this Wrightsville footage, but we really don't get the premise spelled out for us until about 15 minutes into the film. That's when an explanation of the title of the film comes in. Can you tell me about, you know, why do it at that point and the structure?
There's a lot in this film that's withheld, really. And I think, even until the very end, the film doesn't show any footage of actual riots. It's all reenactments and kind of the surrounding media coverage, people talking about what happened, but you don't see what actually happened until the very, very end of the film. And it was a really conscious strategy of holding off. It's not a cliffhanger-ish sort of tension, but it's an intellectual tension as to what's going on in this film. And this Wrightsville that's set up visually in the very open is meant to sort of be a disturbing memory in your mind before you find out what it was actually used for. The specter of the police and military peeking around the corners in the footage that you see early I mean, hopefully it's memorable in the audience's mind enough to wonder what it was. And then that gives a sense of satisfaction when you find out what it was. I mean, that's a technique I think all editors and storytellers use, is if you have some information or a question and then an answer, often the more interesting the answer, the farther you want to put it from the question, because I think the questions sort of develop in the audience's mind. They ripen, they get richer and deeper with time. I think your subconscious in a sense is thinking those questions through. And then when the answers come, it's all the more satisfying.
The film is described, or I heard, saw it described, as an archival film. Is that difficult for you? You know, sometimes I know documentary film editors will say, hey, you know, could we get an interview with somebody, or I've got an interview that I would love to cover. Can you go shoot something for me? You couldn't do that.
There are really two answers to that question. One is to say that there's a richness in archival that comes from its distance from now and comes from the tension between the reason that it was originally created and the reason it's being reused. I think it inherently has a ton of subtext because of that. The audience's mind is drawn to its subtext because you sense that it had a different meaning originally. So I love using it because it's that much deeper in a way, right off the bat. But the second part is, as an editor, in a way, what's the difference? I mean, I could be using an interview from 40 years ago, or I could be using an interview from 4 days ago. And to me, they're fairly equivalent.
You were in Adobe Premiere for this as an NLE. Talk to me about organizing the project so that you could find what you want, so that you could have your hands on the material that you wanted to have your hands on. How did you organize things?
So Sierra sent me a hard drive with years of research that she's been conducting, tons of archival material that went into the Premiere system. And I believe Sierra had arranged it kind of by subject matter. And I think I went along with that. But what I do often is make really long sequences out of stuff. So I took all the material that was related to, for example, tear gas. There was a lot of tear gas material. So I took it all and put it all in one sequence that was probably, you know, 6 or 8 hours long. And when it's in that sequence, then I watch through and put markers in there and kind of mark interesting visual material, or mark, sort of a on the fly transcript of sorts that I can go back to at any time during the project. But the fun of that for me is that it forces you, when you're looking for something in that 6 hour pile, you kind of slide past and happen to see all the material that has anything to do with tear gas. And it can create some opportunities for finding an extra shot or finding an extra concept or kind of the synthesis way of thinking, rather than just finding the exact words that you need or the exact thing you're looking for. You find that and a lot more. Anyway, I made, in this case, a lot long sequences by subject matter.
What are some of the other sequences that you made that helped you, that you can remember?
Tanks. A lot of the police forces were just beginning to use military hardware at that time. So we had a long tanks section. There was the Riotsville footage itself. There were the long sequences from what you come to at the end of the film, the Republican National.
Or not in Chicago.
Not in Chicago. Yeah, this is in Miami.
Democratic.
Yeah, in Miami Beach. It was the same year as the infamous Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
So there is a helicopter, and you actually see the helicopter. You know it's a helicopter. Maybe it starts out sounding like a helicopter, but it transitions, or it starts sounding not like a helicopter, almost synthesized. What was the purpose of that?
So I want to credit Leandros Natunis, the sound designer on the film, who did amazing work, took these opportunities that we had to blend natural sounds with sound effects, of course, and then blend those into these sounds that we were working with that came from the archival footage. One of the things we were really interested in was the sound of the tape, in a way. A lot of archival comes to you with no sync sound at all, and it's these hisses or rumbles, you know, kind of an array of analog noise. So we were playing with those and working those in with sounds throughout the film and kind of blending in and out what was a real sound versus what was a kind of a mood that would create some of the ominous feel of what you're seeing.
I recently talked to a couple of people about the reason why you would not just cut from one image to another, but to have black in between. I don't know whether you can remember specifics about this film, but why would you choose to cut to black?
I love cutting to black, and I've been trying it for a long time. I feel like it gives this reminder of not just of the editing, but of the source of the archival footage. I mean, when you're watching archival, when it comes in, we sort of wanted to remind or open people into that part of the process. It has holes, it has silences, it has beginnings and endings in its very nature. So we didn't want this to feel like a seamless, you know, immaculate edit. We wanted it to feel a little hairy and a little strange. And that comes from Sierra's background and I think also an aesthetic sort of brutality to it that works for the subject matter.
Yeah. I talked to, I just remember who it was that I talked to about black last, which was Hank Corwin. And he did it in Don't Look Up. And I asked him about that. And he said, I kind of consider black like the ginger when you're eating sushi that cleanses your palate.
Yeah. I mean, in music, there rests, you know, like a silence in music and a silence in dialogue, you know, silence is very powerful. And in fact, we make sort of explicit references to other silences in this film as well. There's a meeting between black activists in the Miami area that was filmed without sound at the time.
One of the other interesting things that you left in that I thought was very interesting is some super slow motion that was obviously created by Twixter or something like it that left some very unusual artifacts in the slow-mo. Talk to me about the value of leaving those or using them to your advantage.
Yeah, that one was a fun one, I think, for an editor. It's kind of a little wink to all the times that you try to use those tools and you're trying not to have any artifacts. And this one, we just had a few seconds of this really compelling footage of these young men soldiers sort of mean mugging at the camera, playing the role of protesters. And they're, for the most part, white kids, you know, in their early 20s or late teens, and they've been asked to portray the enemy on some level. And this is during Vietnam, where these soldiers may or may not be there of their own full free will. And we have a few seconds of this, and then we have voiceover that's talking about this tension between what we're seeing and what the Riotsville experiment was meant to be at the time, and then what it really means, or what we can bring to it now. I mean, we say, you know, it's a picture of the state's response to the historical moment. And so we wanted to take that few seconds of these guys kind of shaking their fists and extend it out over enough time to hold the voiceover that we had written for that moment. And so I just put a giant, you know, play it back at 4% speed and put on the optical flow or whatever the tick box is to try to draw it out that far. And of course, I knew it would happen that it would have crazy artifacting, you know, kind of like ghost images and tattered corners and strange blobs moving around on the screen. And I looked at it and I was like, I kind of love this, and, you know, sent it over to Sierra. I mean, Sierra and I have known each other for a long time, and I kind of knew she would like it, and she loved it. And I think there's, again, something about touching between the now and the then, the digital, you know, artifacting, the digital manipulation of this footage, and then what it was before. There's also time, and then just aesthetics. During several of these VO sections, we want to give the audience something to look at, but not an overwhelming amount of visual information so that they can hear and appreciate the writing, which is really dense. And it's at a high level that Toby's written the voiceover material.
And you had some great footage that was super pixelated or was halftone images. Talk to me about the use of those and why hide as much as possible the actual image that you're trying to show.
the halftone sequence that we called it runs for a few minutes again over voiceover section. And it's a blend of ultra close-ups within one photograph of people's faces and the butts of a rifle and the face of the police, a helmet, and protesters kind of staring and yelling at each other. But it showed in such close-up that, I mean, I can see the eyes and the nose because I put them there. I don't know if audiences can quite make that out or if it's...
I sometimes can make out a face.
Yeah, there's a word for it. I think it's like periodic or something for the brain's ability to find faces in images. And I think there's some of that going on that you might see something, but we try to, you know, various levels, you know, 10% closer in or 10% further out. We didn't want you to take much away from the image. We wanted to remain in a really abstract world, remain in an abstract level. And part of that was to in a practical sense, to keep your mind on the visual, on the audio at the time. And then another part was part of the withholding that I mentioned earlier, that we were not wanting to show images of the real violence at the time on the streets. And that was a photograph that you're seeing that's in close up and would probably fall under the category of material that we don't show for most of the film. And there you're kind of getting it, but it's obscured in a way that's kind of intriguing, but also impossible to fully read.
What's the responsibility of the editor and director in a documentary towards truth? The documentary has a viewpoint. It's not just journalism, it's a documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's always been a lot of tension between those two things within documentary and within, you know, to what degrees are documentaries journalism and to what degrees are documentaries expressive? And of course, there's a wide spectrum, I think, in terms of those. But our intention with this film was always that it was a political film, a commentary on the state's sort of inexcusable failure to react to this moment of, in essence, possibility. I mean, there were these uprisings in the 60s that gave us an opportunity, in a way embodied by the Kerner Commission at the time, to fix the problems that we knew about way back then, to provide housing, employment, education to these inner cities that were rising up at that time. And a, you know, very moderate commission recommended to the entire United States. I mean, there were Republicans on this commission who signed off on this idea that we have to pour money into Black communities in order to make up for all of the problems that have been, you know, forced upon them since slavery. The country got that report. They read it. They loved it in a way. They everybody agreed with it. And nothing was done. And that moment closes. And looking back at that moment from the moment of now is what the film does. That's not just facts. That's an interpretation of history, but a much more emotional and a much richer story than simply pure history of that time. And I think the writing and the VO and the tone and the music and all those things serve to comment on those moments. That's, again, the richness of the archival film approach, is that the tension between now and then resonates really powerfully.
Mm-hmm. And the film definitely does not just take its archival from, for example, this Riotsville stuff. It's from all over the place. And one of the places that I thought was real interesting the use of was the PBL, which is the early version of what PBS has become now, right? Can you talk to me about the use of the PBL logo and kind of the video tearing and all that kind of interesting stuff, and the music almost a score in there?
Yeah, we found these broadcasts from the Public Broadcast Laboratory, it was called, and it was kind of a pre-PBS or right at the beginning of PBS experimental, like, weekly news show. They were putting together these segments that were really politically aware, you know, quite leftist in a way. I mean, they eventually were essentially canceled because they were too far left. It was beautifully shot, beautifully lit, really well thought out material with panels of all Black scholars, for example, talking about the effect of the riots on the Black community, or full uninterrupted musical performances by protest musicians, or interesting segments for example, on the women who are the white women in Detroit who are learning to fire weapons at the shooting range. So they were making really compelling programming at that time. And we hadn't seen much of it. I mean, I think bits and pieces of it are around. But to live in that moment and appreciate what was going on at PBL was part of, you know, was a little bit of a shout out to them that we wanted to carry through. And so we do within the Riotsville USA tell a little bit of that story of what PBL was, what they did, and then the end of that programming, even the 70s with Nixon brought in a sort of backlash against public funding of any kind for anything. You see how there was a moment there for really compelling broadcast programs for the entire United States. And now that feels impossible.
Yeah, you referenced two things that I wanted to talk about with that PBL footage. And one is that PBL ran in this entire protest song, but then in the documentary, you guys seemed like you ran the entire protest song. Can you talk to me about that decision? Like, why wasn't an excerpt enough? What was the decision-making process of leaving this entire protest song in?
Yeah, so this is a song by Jimmy Collier, who's really well-known folk protest singer from the time he used to open for Martin Luther King. And his songwriting partner and performing partner, whose name was Reverend Frederick Douglass Kirkpatrick. And we have them performing an entire musical number called Burn Baby Burn. And it's a song that essentially explains the point of view of somebody who's a rioter in reaction to the way that their life has been circumscribed by their circumstances. And it's a great song and really, you know, pretty radical in its content, and interesting that the PBL showed it nonstop like that. And it was one actually that Martin Luther King was a little uncomfortable with. He asked Collier not to perform it before his speeches because he felt like it was a little
too incendiary,
a little farther than he wanted. Yeah, a little incendiary, no pun intended. Pun intended. So we thought, well, you can play this film in an excerpt, you know, as a documentary usually would, but the verses and the words to it were so rich and important that if you excerpt it at all, it kind of takes away from that. You get this chance within this film to do what really rarely happens in a movie and just watch a performance beginning to end with, you know, nobody commenting about what it meant at the time and no cutaways, no nothing. In a way, a commentary on the way documentaries usually work. Usually things are cut down. We're going to give you something uncut here.
Love it. And the other thing that was in there in a similar place was this discussion with these black intellectuals in a round table. Talk to me about trying to cut that and make it make sense, have it say the things you want to do, have it provide the right tone that you want it to provide. I love the fact that they're all sitting in a TV studio and everyone is smoking.
Yeah. This is a great scene. They're puffing away. You know, maybe two of them have cigarettes, one a cigar and one a pipe. The smoke is billowing around the studio. And I mean, that's a kind of humorous element to it that I'm always looking for as an editor, you know, something to kind of, you know, bring a bit of a wink or a smile into something. But the analysis that these guys are doing of the immediate political situation is just devastating. So when you listen to it, I mean, these are some of the smartest thinkers of the second half of the century, Bayard Rustin among them. They're talking about, you know, what is the reaction of the white world to what's going on in these cities. Actually, it's one of the key moments in the film where their clarity on what's happening and what's about to happen is a little depressing, but also dead on. And cutting stuff like that is just such a pleasure when the content is good. I mean, to go back to merch, you can get away with a lot of discontinuities when you've got A-plus material coming through. And I mean, of course, we cut it, you know, fairly continuously. And when you have a couple camera angles, you can grab some reaction shots to patch things up. But mostly when the material is compelling, the cutting, you have a lot of room.
There's a really excellent little edit that I loved in there, but I want to find out from you why you did it, other than kind of the wink idea that you just talked about. There's an ABC announcer that starts talking about Riotsville. He's actually explaining it back in the day that there's this thing. And you use two takes. You show not just him doing the intro once, but you show him doing the intro twice.
Yeah, he does his intro. Welcome to Riotsville. This is a stage riot in a stage city or something. He has this kind of like classic newscaster spiel that he gives. And then without stopping, well, he pauses for a second after he runs through it once and he does it again. I mean, we're licensing that material from ABC, so it costs twice as much money to have him run it twice. The value of it was always clear to us that it shows how constructed and scripted in a way that the media's approach to this is as well.
The other thing that's like that is there's the Witchcraft segment. Witchcraft was one of those tanks that they created for Riot Control, and it had text on the screen, but also kind of drew back the curtain on the stand-up performance of the reporter.
Yeah, the reporter sort of seems to be laughing at how stupid this tank is that they're selling. And it was a stupid looking tank called the Witchcraft, which I find to be a great name, actually. But it was a tank full of 15, a little like out of shape looking police officers who pile out of it like clowns and it's spraying tear gas around as it putts around in a field full of flowers. It's a very absurd sort of situation. But the reason that footage was shot was because the manufacturer of the Witchcraft wanted to sell witchcrafts, and they got ABC to show up there to do a news story, putting that in quotes, but it was really indistinguishable from a PR event. And of course that happens all the time, and there's some news value to it, but it was clear to us that the newscaster himself kind of knew that it was a farce. It's another great example of this research that Sierra did to find these strange dailies from that news footage. I mean, that wasn't footage that was broadcast. That we had the dailies that they were working from.
Talk to me about the choice. One of the choices I loved that was not score was the choice of music over the Riotsville Sniper segment of Soldier Boy.
Yes, the Shirelles, and that was a song from a big chunk of music from the time that had appealed to Sierra, who had researched not only footage, but also music from that time. She's a great musical thinker as well. She'd sent me a bunch of stuff, a Spotify playlist of all sorts of material from that time. And when I heard that song, I was like, oh, this is really interesting, like you said, a bubblegum ode to the soldier. But I think with any of that pop music, it's really deeper than it sounds. And I think the level of irony that we see in terms of what's going on the screen during that sequence, I think it works with the music. I don't think we're taking it and taking it out of context entirely as sort of bringing up some of the subtext in it or questioning what are all the thoughts that song may have come up with.
But it's really juxtaposed. Explain a little bit about what the footage is that it's over, or the segment that it's over, because as you said, it's real bubblegum, but that is not the segment that you were cutting.
Right. That's the sniper attack scenario that was part of every Riotsville demonstration. And in it, they would have somebody firing a rifle from a window of the fake appliance store that was in the little town. And sniper was firing at police or firing at civilians, and everybody's kind of running around and demonstrating for the audience of the Riotsville production the havoc that a sniper could wreak, and then the show shows that you kind of need a tank in order to stop these snipers. Of course, justifies a lot of military spending and militarization of the police via this scenario. And we show several of these scenarios that were filmed, different ones at Riotsville, kind of intercut together. Of course, it was pretty well documented that snipers were between non-existent and barely existent in these actual uprisings, and that the reaction to the snipers, not only of buying tanks in the medium to long run and militarizing police, but even at the time they were just shooting back into open apartment windows in the cities, and several people, innocent people, women, children, were killed or maimed by police and military forces. And it was all part of the legend of the sniper. I mean, it was a constructed story that there were snipers everywhere, sniper kings, nests of snipers were words used in the media. And just a story to I won't totally ascribe that this is what they meant to do, but it certainly caused the police and the troops to be quick to fire at anybody who was moving in an apartment window at the time.
Yeah. that's terrifying. You were saying at the beginning that you do a lot of remote work. You're in California near Los Angeles, Southern California. Where are you?
Oakland, actually. Yeah,
Oakland. You're in Oakland. Yep. Near the Bay Area, and a lot of your editors are in New York or on the East Coast or anywhere else. Talk to me about editing remotely, but also how you collaborate socially with these people.
Working with Sierra Pettengill on this project is a great example of that. I met Sierra years ago at a conference for documentary filmmakers and, you know, kind of like a networking event of some sort in Los Angeles. And she had something she'd written there and I was on a panel and, you know, we just became friends and of course saw each other at festivals over the years. And when she was finally ready to edit this film, because we had a good relationship and really valued each other's work, it seemed like an easy choice to decide to work together. On that level, it's like, oh, that's simple. But Sierra's based in New York. I'm based in Oakland. This was during COVID. Working remotely across a few time zones was just a natural outcome of working together in a way. We did the things that I often do working with directors in New York, which is that I watch footage that they send. We have these great talks about it. Sometimes in person, you know, we'll visit each other for a few days at a time. But the bulk of the process is me cutting and then showing cuts, you know, on a daily or every other day schedule with the director. And then we watch the things and talk about them. And it's really kind of a nice way to separate the, you know, particulars of editing, the sort of tedium of, you know, which shot is it, what's the edit, you know, what's the cut, what level do I want the audio to be in this clip at this moment, which I think is the bread and butter of editing, but the bread and butter of the collaboration is discussing what these scenes mean to each other and what they mean to the film. And so Sierra and I had these great discussions watching every scene that we were making over and over again and kind of talking about what it meant for the film and less, you know, which shot or which edit, but more what's the point of what we're doing, which is a great way to work.
Yeah. And what about the collaboration as you get everything more in context? You were talking about the collaboration of individual scenes, but then when you start to develop a reel or a big long section of 30 minutes, then what kind of collaboration is happening and how are you doing it?
Early in the process, I'll be sending scenes, but as I think a lot of editors do, my first goal is to put together essentially a rough cut of the film. I don't usually work towards an assembly. I work towards what I think of as a rough cut, but a working version of the film, something in the ballpark of like an hour to 2 hours long that you can watch in one sitting and that has something that feels like a beginning, middle, and end as a starting point in terms of the discussion of how the film works. Some of the times we're working in a particular scene and tweaking those elements, and then other times we're rearranging scenes or rearranging sections of the film. So a lot of what I'm sending back and forth to any director, but in this case with Sierra, were full cuts of the film. You'd sit and you'd watch it on your computer and then we'd talk about it as a holistic thing, not just frame to frame or cut to cut level. It was always about meaning and the bigger picture.
Mm. That's a great place for us to end this conversation, I think, on the bigger picture. And thank you, Nell, so much for talking to us about this really interesting film that was at Sundance.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. It's a great pleasure talking to you. I appreciate your really insightful questions about editing. Thanks for having me on.
That's it for this special Voices from Sundance episode of Art of the Cut. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to my guest, Nels Van Gerder, for joining us for this special Voices from Sundance episode of Art of the Cut. Thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. I edited today's podcast using Adobe Audition. If this is a podcast you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews with the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember, if you have a friend in the film business or aspires to be in the film business, don't forget to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and frame.io.